This is where we meet, sharing conversations from New Mexico and beyond. I'm Alice Morillon. Taos Center for the Arts would like to recognize that it operates on the homelands of the Red Willow people of Taos Pueblo. We'd like to honor the ongoing dedication and importance of Native and Indigenous cultures within our community and within the land we live, learn, and exist on. Our guest today is Ray Archuleta. Ray Archuleta is a farmer who lives in Semmer, Missouri, and grew up in Española, New Mexico. Archuleta earned an associate degree in livestock science from Northern New Mexico College and a bachelor degree in agricultural biology from New Mexico State University. For 30 years, he worked for the Natural Resources Conservation Service before retiring in 2017. He then focused on teaching biomimicry strategies and agroecology principles for improving soil function on a national scale. In late February 2024, a coalition of agricultural entities invited Ray Archuleta and Alejandro Carrillo, a rancher from Mexico, to Taos. Together, they presented, discussed, walked field, and connected with the community over regenerative agriculture principles. During that weekend, I sat down with Archuleta and recorded this conversation. In this recording, we start by identifying the core aspects of regenerative agriculture. You may see it as a crash course into the topic. It's a little dense, but stay with us. Archuleta also talks of the importance of nature's ways, community and food as medicine, how to apply the principles of regenerative agriculture with acequia farming, and probably most important of all, the importance of hope. During our conversation today, we are referring to regenerative agriculture. It can be distinguished from traditional and even organic farming because of the step back it takes from chemical and mechanical actions to better resemble what really happens in nature. It reduces the amount of inputs, such as fertilizer or pesticides, and disruptive action, like tilling your field before you plant it, and it includes the use of cover crops and animals. Its goal is to restore the biodiversity in the soil. According to the Nobel Research Institute, at its core, regenerative agriculture is the process of restoring degraded soils using practices based on ecological principles. That is to say, it mimics nature's ways in balanced ecosystems. It results in better carbon retention and restoration of water cycles. Before I leave you with Ray Archuleta, I want to quote him. He entices us to be hopeful and, quote, to be well-versed and go regen. Here is Archuleta adding thoughts to the brief definition of regenerative agriculture that I just gave.
I like to keep that definition a lot simpler.
Okay.
And I would like to say that in real simple is, it's regenerative agriculture is like really asking nature, how do you do business? It's kind of how do you emulate it? How do you mimic it? How do you understand its patterns, its principles? Because there's patterns and there's principles, these ecological principles, and how can we emulate it? How can we nurture nature so that it increases biodiversity and heals not only human communities, but biological communities, also increasing nutrient density and also bringing healthy food to the communities? Because at the end of the day, we want our food to be our medicine. So regenerative agriculture can address a lot of these major issues. So in simple, how do we mimic nature?
Thank you. What does that look like, really, for a farmer or a rancher that is trying to apply those principles of mimicking nature? What are the key elements or principles that you see working?
Yeah, one of the things when I went, I spent 8 years in the university, I didn't realize, it just didn't dawn on me, and I think a lot of us forgot that we focused so much on the area where the farm was, but we forgot to realize that the farm came from the forest. It came from the prairie. Well, what's common in both of those systems? They both have animals in the system. They're both beautiful. They have insects. There's diversity. Plants that have different structure, different architecture. Simply said is biodiversity. It should be beautiful. It doesn't till. The tillage equipment that nature uses is earthworms and living biology, critters, arthropods, things that bore into the soil. So from a farmer's perspective, is going to a no-till farming is using a special planter so you don't have to do tillage. when you're finished growing your corn and soybean, you plant a cover crop that looks like the prairie, looks like the forest, and you never leave that ground bare. So in natural systems, you always have living roots, and you have a living skin. That residue, those leaves, they're always covering and blanketing that soil and feeding it. I think that's the thing when we talk to farmers is stop doing so much tillage. Cover the ground at the end of the year. And if the, and when you do put a cover crop, it should be beautiful. It should be diverse. So that's what regenerative agriculture looks like.
Thank you. So if I pick up correctly, you mentioned animals, biodiversity, and diversity of crops, really, that you're putting on that soil to never leave it bare.
Yeah.
Is that the gist?
Yeah. And the thing is, people, I think people don't understand who are not in agriculture, nature does not farm without animals. Prairie has animals. The forest has animals. And I think there's a lot of confusion today is that we cannot heal our deserts without grazing animals. Those deserts were once prairies, and the only way to restore them is to bring grazing animals back into the system.
Thank you. And I wonder if you could tell us a little more about what kind of grazing we're talking about, because, you know, cattle is grazed in regular agriculture all the time. They're out on fields. But I think with regenerative agriculture, we're looking at a very specific way, a very intentional way of using the animals to restore the soil. And what exactly does that look like?
Well, beautiful. Thanks for the question. Really, what it looks like is like a migratory of the buffalo or the Serengeti. These animals are always moving. They never stay in one spot to overgraze one particular area. But that concentration, that density of animals increases hoof action, but it puts manure and urine to feed soil biology and keeps the grasslands healthy. And so currently all over the world, we graze like this. We throw the cows into one paddock. We'll come and check on them 2 weeks or 3 weeks, depending on the size of the paddock, and they overgraze, take everything to the ground. And then when environmental groups or other people see it, the land looks terrible. Mm-hmm. The riparians are overgrazed. And that's the issue is you have to be very intentional and you have to know the goal. So what's the goal? Again, mimicking the natural system's grazing patterns. That's biomimicry. That's mimicking the nature in itself. And that's what we're saying. It's very simple. If we did this, we could restore all our rangelands, all our grasslands, and we would not be talking about the climate. It would heal itself.
Right, because the benefits is with a healthier soil, the carbon is better retained with the plants, drawing it from the air. And then the water cycle is also restored. Can you tell us a little more about that and how that works?
Well, I'm glad that you even mentioned the water cycle because that's rarely ever discussed. We know scientifically that 60% of our rain comes from the ocean. 40% comes from inland, from trees and plants that evapotranspire. And then that humidity creates cloud formation. The problem we're having is right now is a disruption of the small water cycle. Is that when you have too much bare ground, about 20 to 30% of our land on a global scale has no plants on it. Right. Absolutely bare. So I tell people our land is not only hungry, so it's hungry, I mean it's naked because it doesn't have its covering because the plants are the covering. Mm-hmm. It's hungry because it's really the plants that feed the microbes. It's thirsty because the water's infiltrating and the water's running off because you're not building aggregates created by biology and roots. And it's dying of a fever because the ground gets so hot and then the heat reflects. So the reality is we have a lot of disrupted ecosystems because we just do not have enough vegetation. That's where it comes with the disrupted water cycle happens. And it's affected the climate everywhere.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's simple. It's too simple because some of the things that people are trying to fix it, it's like one person from Harvard thinks, why don't we just get 10,000 airplanes? And they're really seriously pondering this. Fill it up with zinc oxide and create a kind of a dusting over and kind of volcano effect, so that what you're doing is you're going to get this rain or the shadowing and get the shadowing to happen and cloud formation to cool the soil surface. the stupidity of it is incredible, because people forgot, they tried to mimic a volcano, but back in the 1700s or the 1800s, there was a summer they called the year without a summer. And a volcano blew up and spewed all kinds of volcanic ash. Mm-hmm. It got cold. Mm-hmm. It was very wet. There was no summer. Who knows how many people went hungry that time? We don't understand the stupidity when you come up with when we come up with ideas like that. It just boggles my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seriously.
And they're really seriously pondering stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, hold on a second. Why don't we just emulate the natural system? There's also talk about getting a giant vacuum cleaner, suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere. And I said, I already know that perfect name of that vacuum cleaner. It's called a plant. Plants already do that, and they do it a lot better than us.
Right.
So that's the grand stupidity of our conversations that we're having on a global scale on how to heal the planet.
Yeah, and so really regenerative agriculture is taking a step back and looking at what works simply.
Yes, and I think every human on the planet can say, wow, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's got design. Mm-hmm. It's elegant. Mm-hmm. It functions. Why don't we just mimic it? Mm-hmm. What a novel idea, huh?
Yeah, all right. So I want to go back to the work you've done throughout your life. You've been engaging with farmers and ranchers for a long time. Yeah. Well, I mentioned earlier in the introduction, you've worked for 30 years with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And then after those 30 years, you decided to focus on teaching biomimicry. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about, and agroecology. Can you tell us why that happened? Why you were like, this needs to shift. My approach to this needs to go this way. And yeah, how did that change happen for you?
Well, it happened to me when I was in the early 2000s. I was in my 40s. I was working and I was actually living in Idaho, and I was a district conservationist in Oregon. And it kind of was getting very frustrating. I was getting very frustrated working with a conservation it used to be called Soil Conservation Service. That agency was designed to solve conservation issues, and the Dust Bowl and the erosion was horrible in the 1930s. That was the purpose, and improve the water and improve the economy for the farmers. And I started to realize none of that was being improved, not to the extent that we should, and we were spending billions as a people. And yet, farmers could not bring their sons and daughters into the operation. The river, the Snake River, would turn to chocolate, be filled with sediment. And then, in fact, they had an algal bloom that killed a couple of dogs that year because the dogs drank the water, mm-hmm. and they died. And I started to question, something's wrong. Our agriculture's wrong. And it was about 2007, going to Gabe Brown's ranch in North Dakota and reading Alan Savory's book on holistic management. Completely changed me. I really realized I missed the mark. 8 years of university, and I was taught agriculture from the wrong premise. Mm-hmm. We were asking the wrong science. See, you can have science behind you, but asking wrong questions. If you build your premise on the wrong question for science, the result's incorrect. Now I have the right question. Ask nature. How do we nurture it? How do we have a relationship? That's how I started. And so I started in my career, in the last 10 years of my career, I went all over the United States, from Puerto Rico, Hawaii, everywhere, like this zealot preaching soil ecology, mm-hmm. Restore the land, let's bring biomimicry, let's teach healing of the land. And farmers loved it. They embraced it. Not so much with our government employees, because I start to realize that our government is being controlled by the industrial chemical complex. You know, instead of the military complex, there's the chemical. It's the big pharma, I call it FARMA, and then there's the big pharma, PHARMA. So we're controlled both sides of the United States, and our decision makers are really controlled by these big corporate America. And so the message was difficult until finally I retired and I realized I had to leave. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. And then Kiss the Ground documentary came out that really propelled me on a global scale.
Well, Kistegren, that was my next question, because from what I understand, the work you were doing until then was really focused on farmers and ranchers. And with Kistegren, really, you reach a much larger population. Suddenly, you were talking to not only people who are actively working with land and livestock, but also anyone who is interested in that topic. And I wonder why that seemed important to you, or if it did at the time.
Be honest, that documentary was 8 years ago. I'd given up on it. There was this group of young people in this nonprofit called Kiss the Ground. And they reached out to me and says, Ray, can we follow you with a camera? And I said, because they heard about my work. And I said, sure, you can. But I said, under one condition, that if you speak to the farmers, you speak with them in humility. Listen to what they're saying. And they agreed. And they were a great group. And so we went all over the country and they filmed me, forgot about it, and said, yeah, we're going to get it into Netflix. I laughed, sure. 8 years later, I get a phone call, and Ryland, who is one of the producers, says, Ray, we're going to get it into Kiss the Ground. We're going to get it into Netflix. And I started to laugh. I said, sure. And I said, and people ask me, well, why did it take 3 years? Because it was $3 million, and that was private donations. And it took 8 years. And then COVID hit. Mm-hmm. But before when it came out in COVID, the reason it got into Netflix, it was because Ryland had a huge, he lives in LA, knows a lot of people, had a lot of vegetarian restaurant, very popular. And he knew DiCaprio.
Oh, wow.
And DiCaprio saw it and he loved it. And he called Netflix, and sure enough, they put it in, and it has 10 million views.
Mm-hmm.
Number 6 on the environmental documentaries on Netflix, and over 1 billion impressions. It's done really, really well, because one of the things I asked the producers, Josh and Rebecca, is leave people with hope. Don't just sit there and say, oh, the world's doomed, we're going to burn up, and it's going to sink into the ocean. People shut down. Humans shut down. It doesn't give them hope. Hope inspires. The documentary does that. And what we're saying is we can heal the planet. This is not something that's very difficult to do. The planet will heal itself. We can do this through agriculture.
Well, I want to go back to something you said when you were sharing at the end of your career with, NRCS.
Right.
That farmers were really taking to that approach, and that what you were sharing, and that actually kind of surprises me, because I feel like it's very different from what most bigger ranchers, farmers are doing, and it's usually hard to change your ways.
Yeah.
So one of my questions is, was that universally well taken, or did you have, what was that process like to approach farmers? And my second question is, you just mentioned before we started recording that you've been all over the world recently. And I wonder who you're talking to when you're traveling that much, and what is the reception to what you're sharing?
Thank you. I'll start with that first part. How did farmers receive this? The first way I always do it is we approach them economically, money, the mm-hmm. house, because they have to make a living. Once we bring them in with economics, and I use various soil demonstrations that are very, very powerful, and let the soil speak to them, because farmers know this. If they can't get the water into the ground, it's going to affect their yield. And if they can't, and they're spending a lot of money on fertilizers, pesticides, and farmers are going broke with those inputs. But when I talk to them and show that if you make the soil healthy, you don't need all those inputs, that brings their intention. Afterwards, they start falling in love with the ecology. They start having relationship. They start understanding what the goal is. And I have a farm, and I used to hate farming. I started hating my farm because I didn't know what the goal was. Now I know. I had a 71-year-old man, farmer, hear me, sold all of his equipment from South Carolina, sold all the tillage, went to no-till, cover crops, saw him a year later, and he says, man, Ray, I love farming now. and because nobody taught us, our grandparents, our parents, our university, nobody said, your goal is to emulate nature, to love it, to nurture it. That's a wonderful message. And it's a message of healing. Now, when I travel, it's the same message. for everybody because we all connect it. Then when we said, if we make the soil healthy and microbes and we take care of them because we can't see them, but they're there and they're important. It's the most biodiverse ecosystem is the soil itself. 50% of all biodiversity is in the soil. But if we make the soil healthy, the plants healthy, the animals healthy, the humans healthy, the climate, the water, it's a win-win. So who's not going to be from environmentalists, well, people that don't even want to eat meat or they're vegetarians, but they understand they all care about the planet. They really do. And I don't think farmers go out there every day and says, you know what, I'm going to get up this morning and see what I can trash. So that doesn't happen. All people, government people, like last night when we were in Taos, let's go back to New Mexico. We had the mayor there. We had leaders there. And once you don't talk down at people, you don't talk with them with scientific jargon, but communicate to them in a very simple way. When we did the soil demonstration, I think you saw that yesterday, that connects with people. Because I know as a teacher, I have a couple of minutes whether I'm going to connect with you or not. And then I let the soil speak. Once you teach them and give them the right goals and the right format and break all the filters and paradigms that we have that we've been taught at school, our families, our paradigms, social conditioning, people start to get it. They start to get engaged. So it's a message for everybody.
You touched on this just now, but I wonder if you can tell us how it's been to come to Northern New Mexico and how specifically with this approach and information, and what's the reception? From what I can tell, it seems pretty positive, but I wonder what your perspective is and if it's specific in any ways.
Well, thank you. I grew up in New Mexico. Our family has been here hundreds and hundreds of years. And so it's always a special place where you grew up and you... But I ache for New Mexico. I see where it's at, and I never understood it on how degraded. Growing up here, I thought this was the way it is. And I was conditioned to that. Now traveling the whole world, and then especially going to Chihuahua, Mexico, where ranchers bringing back the desert and bringing it back to the prairie, I got to go back in time 400 or 500 years. Like a time machine. So when I walked on Alejandro Carrillo's ranch, I saw what the Spaniards saw when the Catholic friars were walking all the way from Mexico and coming up to establish Pueblo, missionaries here. I got to see that. And when I saw that, it gave me an incredible amount of hope. I've seen regeneration happen in the most severe conditions in Africa. This is spreading globally. So why back to New Mexico? Because it hurts to see New Mexico and water is so scarce. It's expensive to live in New Mexico. The private land is very limited. Water's the issue. I saw streams and creeks dry up that I thought would never dry up in my lifetime. Growing up here, we used to get snow in the valley in Española, 30 inches. We used to have trout in the irrigation ditches. We have none of that. It's becoming more and more erratic because that small water cycle and the West is becoming more and more desertified. So the 100 meridian is the separation, is moving further east and becoming more drier. So it's really important to understand how things are getting very, very dry. Mm-hmm. And so coming back to New Mexico has been amazing. And the people in Taos and the natives here, that have been here, and I call the natives from Native Americans, but also the people that have been here for hundreds and hundreds of years, like myself, absolutely excited. I mean, excited. They have hope. And it just giving them sparks of faith and hope that they can heal the place and maybe even make some supplemental income. Instead of having to support it, it also helps bring the next generation. So they're very excited.
Thank you. Well, I want to shift the conversation specifically towards Northern New Mexico. And actually, my first question about that is not an agricultural question. It's a personal question.
Sure.
You grew up in Española, and I wonder what that was like. And when you look back on it now, what you see in that childhood, younger years of your life, like those formative time, what did New Mexico give you?
Well, New Mexico, there's a reason it's called the land of enchantment. It's stark landscapes, it's beauty. I think what New Mexico did for me, because I used to go every summer I could to work on my uncle's ranch in Coyote and Gallina area, Coyote area. Because my dad's originally from the Coyote area. That's very north of Abiquiu. I loved it. I always wanted to be a rancher. Being out there in the mountains and with the cattle and bucking bales and made a heavy impression. Even though I lived in town in Espanola, I knew as a kid at 15 I was going to go get a degree in agriculture. Then I went and got an associate's degree in Arito in the community college. And that was a big thing for me because they had a program back in the 80s that they would pay young people that had a grant to go get a degree in agriculture. And so I applied and I got in and I loved it. And then that just inspired me to go get my bachelor's and then go to graduate school. But Espanola, I mean, New Mexico brought that to me. But on the flip side, I also saw the sadness as how the land was still getting degraded and it was not utilized well. And living in Oregon, it made me realize that Oregon has one of the most wise land use laws, land use zoning in the country. Mm-hmm. For example, you can't build a house unless you have 80 acres irrigated or 300 acres dry land. They do not allow you build hotels on the edge of the ocean beach. So I would envision if we would have thought and been thoughtful back then, hundreds of years ago, all the land that it's, all the houses would be built on the sand hills that you can't produce food, but all of our irrigated ground would be so protected. Now, if you go from Valadre all the way, this valley, there's the congestion of the houses and breaking it up, and then septic tanks, and then water quality problems. It just wasn't thought up well. And so one of the sad things that you see now, not just in New Mexico, but on the national scale, is the rural America is becoming more and more impoverished. And because a lot of the money and wealth is not going to the local community, it's going to corporate America. And which leads to more drug abuse. And, you know, in my street in Espanola, I think over 30% of the kids I grew up with died of alcoholism or drug abuse. So those are the stark realities of not just New Mexico, but it's all over nationally. Mm-hmm. And so the blessings of the land doesn't necessarily go to the local community anymore. Mm-hmm. It goes to people that own the land or industrial agriculture. People that sell the tractors, the chemicals, and the fertilizers. So that's the reality of where we're at globally.
Thank you. I feel like in many ways that connects to the message you have as far as how to empower people in using their land and making it profitable. Because a lot of people in New Mexico, families that have been here for generations, still own land. And, yeah. and having the right tools, and if there's the desire to, you know, farm it and regenerate it, that might be an avenue for them to have that ownership, like expand and bring back to them. So I think that's...
It's important because I think we were all designed to love the garden. Mm-hmm. The beauty of gardening, if people can go touch the soil and what it does for them, it brings a solace to them, but it also connects families to teach our kids how to grow their own food and how they're connected to the land. And I think we're having a lot of our social issues, our cultural issues, our spiritual issues, our emotional issues, our health issues just because we're not connected anymore. We're mm-hmm. very disconnected as a people. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying, let's connect back. And I've had a lot of the tribes reach out to me too, the Native American tribes. And so that's really cool because a lot of us in here in New Mexico don't realize a lot of us are part Native American too because we lived here so long. But this message resonates with the Native Americans also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Well, to go back to
the landscape of New Mexico, we all know this is a high altitude desert. It's a challenging climate to grow food, to have animals. It's also a landscape that you touched on that has evolved in the past 500 years. It used to be grasses here, and now we have sagebrush. And I wonder if you could tell us about maybe what's happening in that ranch in Chihuahua and how regenerative agriculture can help mitigate that issue and bring back grasses. And also, how does that, what does that look like for somebody who wants to do it? Can somebody with an acre of land that has sagebrush bring back grasses there? Yeah. And how do they do that?
Yeah, I don't think most people realize it's not about scale. It's the methodology. It's about the goals. It can work on 1 acre. It can work on half an acre. But it can work on hundreds of thousands of acres. That's the beautiful thing about ecological principles. You just need to learn how to apply the principles within your context, whether it be an acre or thousands. So give you an example. Alejandro runs, when he first started, his ranch was very degraded. His dad wanted him to come back. They owned 30,000 acres. But they could only run 100 cows. And it was that degraded. Mm-hmm. But he took parts of the ranch that are the better parts of the ranch and started building it and moving the cows. Like, now he's got 500.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he's changed the local climate on his ranch. He gets more rain now. He would like to grow more cows. Now he's bringing donkeys in. He's bringing sheep. So here's the point. Diversity. How can we stack? If you live here in San Cristóbal, where you only got 1 acre of irrigation, what can you do with that? A lot. You can put beehives in there. You got irrigated water. You can grow, if you have irrigated water, you can grow all your food. So there's many things you can do. And another thing I want to stress, you can work in community. Mm-hmm. In other words, you got, what I love about San Cristóbal and Taos, you guys are willing to work with each other. Say you got 100 acres down this whole irrigation with La Sequia group. And you say you all put in a co-op of, you got 30 or 40 cows. And you all move the cows within your land. So, okay, Alisa, it's your time to move the cows within your acre. Group them up. You got maybe an hour because you only got that much vegetation on your 1 acre. Move them to the next one. The other neighbor gets it. Then you work as community. I tell people, don't do this by yourself. It's too complex. Work with community. Then if you have 5 or 10 people in your community or 20, now, and you're all doing demonstration research on your place, now you got 20 years of research in 1 year. So there's a lot of things you can do to bring restoration.
Well, that's really inspiring. And the community part is very exciting. It makes a lot of sense, especially with land that's not nearly as large as, 30,000 acres. So we need one another to work that land and combine the resources.
That's what this country needs to do. I'll say this real quick about food. I think the listeners need to really think about food this way. I'll never forget the little magazine quote. It goes like this. If the food is spectacular and it's delicious, that if you invite family members you do not like, maybe you really don't like them, but if the food is magnificent, you might even forgive them and you break bread with them. Food is a sanctimonious experience. Mm-hmm. It's something very precious. We don't do that anymore as a family. When I raised my daughters, every night we would sit together as a family and we'd eat together. Mm-hmm. It's a blessing to be able to do that. And I think we need to do as a community, not in front of the TV, not in front of the phone, but sit together as a people and say, hey, we grew this. And then we can commune. So we have to change the way we as a people in many, many facets.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. To go back to something you said about the garden you grow with wood chips, in New Mexico, a lot of traditional irrigation is flood irrigation. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that presents some challenges with, covering the ground. When we tried to do that here, we had a cover crop that we just bent down, and then our rows where the water was supposed to flow, it was just really slow. And it was presenting some challenges. And so I don't know if you have any tips off the top of your head for everybody here who's irrigating with an acequia, how they can still very well work with the principles you're bringing up.
It's very good, because see what happens when you're doing a cover crop and you roll it down, you're going to increase the aggregation of the pore space. So the water's going to have a hard time. See, flood irrigation works real well if the soil's destroyed and tilled, because you can push the water away at the very little small pores. As you get the soil healthier, you get bigger and bigger pores. That means the water infiltrates better and it holds the water better. So what I would do in the sake is I would create a sump pump. In other words, a little box, an irrigation box. Put a pump in there that runs on solar power. And then it doesn't run expensive, put some PVC pipe and use sprinkler. It's much more efficient. And it actually emulates more nature because it comes like rain. Hmm. Flood irrigation is very, very inefficient. Absolutely horrific inefficiency. You just to get the water from the beginning of the source to the field ditches, you can lose 30-40% just through infiltration losses.
Right, but it's still going back to the ecosystem, right? Like even if it's not going to your garden or your field, it's contributing to your place.
I think there's a balance on both. I think there's been an argument, keep the sakias. And I said, okay, you can still keep your sakia, but what about the field ditches? You're still losing a lot of water. You're still being inefficient. Water is precious. If 1 inch of water is in an acre, is 27,154 gallons. And if you divide that, if alfalfa needs, for the whole year, needs 30 inches, you're talking millions of gallons that you did not use effectively. Mm-hmm. We need to start thinking about how we use the water and how, yes, some of the ecosystem get benefit about it, but remember, you still have to make a living, you still have to produce food. But when it gets to the field, there's a lot. I would put mine in a sprinkler because the pumping cost for me is worth it. Or you can run it on solar, or you can run it in a much more efficient, because water is precious.
What about the regularity, you know, like you can only irrigate your field so often with, you know, the ditch and everybody using it.
Yeah.
So it seems like my understanding, and you can correct me, is that if you're flooding it, you're getting the water deeper than if you're using a sprinkler. And so if you are flooding it and then you're getting water again in a month, maybe the impact of that deeper irrigation will be more beneficial because the water will go deeper, and for that month afterward it's going to be okay. Whereas if you're using a sprinkler, I would be worried that it's only getting to the surface of that field, and then, you know, it's going to dry out in the month that comes, especially if the monsoon is not here yet.
Well, one of the things that I used to design irrigation systems, in fact I spent 6 years in Las Cruces, and it's actually the opposite. What happens is if you put too much water, the soil goes anaerobic. There's too much water, not enough oxygen. And then you shut down the microbes. And then what happens for a period of time, you lose nitrogen in the system. So that's not a good thing. Just because we have water and it's very efficient, inefficient. So like example, I just told you, if I want to put 2 inches level on that whole 1 acre, but because my system's so inefficient, I have to use 5 inches of water to push the 2 inches out there. Mm-hmm. So you've lost thousands of gallons. And then when it does get to the end, it subs to others, goes to the gopher hole. You lose a lot of water and an inefficient. The application efficiency of a flood system is about 25%.
Wow.
And that's considering if it's laser level, 20 to 50%. So that's a lot of water loss. Mm-hmm. Okay. If everybody in the sakia had a way more distribution and efficiency, you can actually irrigate more acres, more fields, more frequently because you have the water there.
Right.
And then the plants also help bring water. Microbes and those deep roots, these plants will seek water down deeper. The snow melts. If you had cover crops during the snow melts, those covers help filter water down deeper into the profile. So I think a lot of people are confused about their irrigation and how the soil ecosystem works. By the way, if you do a lot of tillage in a flood system, you destroy all the aggregates up in the first 1 or 2 inches, and the majority of the water doesn't infiltrate anyway, and it runs off faster to the end.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you destroyed aggregate stability, porosity. You destroyed it with our flood systems. So it doesn't work that way. I used to think of the same thing. It's a very inefficient system. We can't afford that.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's kind of sad.
Yeah, it is.
All right. Well, thank you for all that. That's very helpful, mm-hmm. very boots on the ground. So we'll use that knowledge. A question that I have that is related to all this is we talked about animals earlier. You have sheep. We have a few here as well. And I would like to touch on how well they can be used in that regenerative agriculture framework. The reason why is because I've done a little bit of research on that, and a lot of people talk about cattle mm-hmm. and how efficient their hooves are and mm-hmm. how much they can thrive off of that taller grass that has less nutrients in it. On the other hand, sheep need more denser nutrient food, and they have smaller hooves. And so I wonder what your take is on how efficient it is to use sheep to, you know, mob graze them and use them to restore the soil, because I think it can be done, and it's easier in many ways to have sheep than cattle, and you can have less sheep than cattle and still have a healthy herd, whereas cattle, anyway, what's your take on sheep?
Well, I raise sheep. I have about 140, 150 head. Sheep require less feed. You can have 6 to 7 sheep for 1 cow. Mm-hmm. They can eat 8 pounds of dry matter per day. Cows need 35 at the minimum. Sheep make more money than cows. If you go to the market, sheep market price is fantastic for the meat. Wool, you can do secondary. I didn't want wool sheep because I sheared one time. I said, I'd never do that again. It's too much work. So I don't want to do that. But sheep are actually very efficient animals, and they don't need as much food. And you can grass finish them a lot better, so they'll be tender. To have a tender grass-finished cow requires a long time. Huh. Notice the key word, finished. That only grasses, no grain, but yet be tender. It takes a long time, and it takes a special genetics. So sheep are wonderful. They're delicious. They're easier. They're easier to manage. But the key thing with sheep, you got to have a guard dog. I have a guard dog. I was losing sheep all because we have coyotes, we live in the forest, we got a lot of coyotes, I was just getting beat up. Once I put guard dogs, fantastic. Mm-hmm. My 90 ewes make my land payment of 155 acres. Mm-hmm. My wife didn't have the skill set on learning how to move the animals. Now she grew up in the city. Now she's a great little rancher. She knows how to move the animals. To start off somebody with cows, with a big animal, you can get hurt. I don't know if I would do that. Now, I want both animals. If you have more space, if I wanted one cow, the cow does have a bigger footprint, bigger manure, and they'll eat things that the sheep won't, but the sheep will eat something that the cows won't. So I think they complement each other. I won't say one is better than the other. They're just different. Mm-hmm. I would like to have both. Mm-hmm. But I would recommend go to a school and learn how to move the sheep first before you go buy sheep and put fence. That's where education and what we teach in grazing schools first before you decide to pick an animal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have a last question to wrap up this conversation. And this is a little bit on the side of what we've been talking about. Up in Cuesta, just up the north, up the road, there was a mine. And now in the soil, you can find some heavy metals and toxins, mm-hmm. also in the water. And I wonder if regenerative agriculture, with the impact it has on the biodiversity within the soil, can help mitigate the effect of those toxins and metals, and even, you know, clean the soil of those elements. I don't know if you can talk to that.
Yeah. Yes, it can. Can regenerative agriculture restore some of these very disturbed areas like mines? They can. In fact, Alejandro has a really good slide deck showing there's a rancher in Chihuahua who had a mine on his ranch, and he wanted to restore it because it was just a big scar on the land. He used cattle and mycorrhizal fungi. He sprayed the fungi, brought hay bales, grouped the cows very tight, manure and urine, completely restored the mine. Also, there's once you get it going, you can bring material like sun hemp. sun hemp has an amazing ability to bring up heavy metals into its body. And then you can ship it out in mass, and then maybe you can relocate it. It's called photoremediation. Wow. Using microbes are amazing. You know, you think about our biota, 90% of us is bacteria. Mm-hmm. 10% of us is us. So if it wasn't for bacteria and good viruses and all these organisms that we can't see, there would be no life on the planet. So yes, we can restore these very degraded areas.
Thank you. Well, that's really, really nice to hear. And yeah, we can look forward to that here in northern New Mexico. Ray, thank you so much. I don't know if there's anything else you would like to add to our listeners here around house in northern New Mexico when they're listening and they feel excited. Any thought?
I want to leave people with a message of hope. I think sometimes we watch a lot of TV with our political process and some of the consternation of going back and forth, and also the doom and gloom. I want to say there's a lot of magnificent things going on globally. Large tracts of land are being healed, but you don't hear it. I'm going to go to Guatemala and go consult on 50,000 acres of sugarcane, and it's going to go regen. There's another farm that contacted me that grows some of the best Cuban cigars in Nicaragua. They want to go regen. This is spreading everywhere. Farmers are catching on that the current industrial ag model doesn't work. There's too many negative side effects. And it was based on the wrong science. It was never based on a science of humility, of asking nature, how should we do business? So I want to leave the public and say, look, be hopeful. The land is being healed. Be part of that. And the way you can be part of it is grow your own vegetables. Get your kids to go out there. Let food be thy medicine. Watch Kiss the Ground documentary. Share it with everybody you can in the common ground. Be well educated. Be well versed. Spend time with your community. Come to some of our schools and classes, and it'll change your life, because it changed my life. So I want to leave people with hope.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Ray Archuleta for sharing his thoughts and work. All the references that Archuleta shared during the interview will be listed in the podcast description. Thank you to Alex Griffiths, Bonin Franklin, Corbett Wicks, Eli Collignan, and Tobias Duncan, who contributed to the design of the conversation. Where We Meet comes from Taos Center for the Arts in Taos, New Mexico. Producers include Chelsea Reedy, Alice Morillon, and Anna Forster-Smith. On Where We Meet, we share conversations from New Mexico and beyond. Thanks for listening. Be well.